Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kim. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 294, recorded May 16th, 2016.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hello.
I think we're back in the saddle, so to speak. We have all kinds of contributors today. 5 different countries.
That's pretty exciting.
We have some multiple submissions. We've got all kinds of things going on. It appears that the email is now working, so go ahead and send things in if you were worried about the email not working. info@aquarimax.com seems to be fixed. Thank you, Web Guru John.
Yay.
He fixed it. All right, so who've we got lined up for the day?
We have Mick in Carnforth, UK, and Joe in Hudsonville, Michigan, Juliet in Paris, France, Jeremiah in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Tom in Provo, Utah, Paul in Central California. We heard from Paul before, she knew.
Yes, we have.
Oh, no, that's Finn. Finn, right. The goldfish. Sorry, Paul. Yeah. Ken in São Mateus. How did you say that?
Yeah,
right?
São Mateus.
Yeah. Brazil. That one's new, right?
Yep.
Yes. And Matt in Perth, Western Australia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're excited that there are so many people that want to be on Aquarimax. So, here we go. Let's start out.
With Mick?
Mick.
Okay. He says, hi guys, glad to hear that you are sticking it out at least until 300 shows. Good to hear more contributors in the last show too. I was wondering if you had considered incorporating a fishy news section in the show from time to time. I know the Baileys did this as a regular start of their pet fish talk shows, and it was often one of my favorite bits. If some of us Aquarimaxers out there are having a quiet but enjoyable time with our own aquariums, we can scan the web for interesting stuff to share. That would be great.
It would be. So please, everybody, feel free to send in fishy bits of news.
Mm-hmm. I've also really enjoyed listening to some of the special interviews you have done. I know these can take some time to arrange, but I'm sure there are many listeners out there who would be happy to share their experiences. I would be happy to do another sometime.
You know, it's interesting that you should bring that up because I've been thinking the very same thing. Great minds think alike, mm-hmm. I guess.
When we've been saying all year, we need to do more interviews. We need to do more interviews. It was just, I don't know, for like the whole year after you move...
Everything's a little
nuts. Still moving. I don't know.
But it's been almost a year now, so.
Yeah, next month.
This is what we were thinking, that we would like to make do a goal or make a goal for one interview per month, approximately. And it might not work out perfectly, but if we were to do one interview per month and see how that goes, I think that would be great. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking what would be really fun is if we made that interview YouTube video hangout, at least when the interviewees were comfortable with it. So we record it as a YouTube video, but it's not heavily dependent on the video for, you know, the content. We make sure that it's accessible to people who are only listening in audio, because once we've recorded it, we do it as a live video interview and it would post immediately to YouTube, and then we would download the audio and post it as the audio show for that week as well.
So that might be a useful idea.
Yeah,
we and do that.
When Aquarimax or interviewees would rather not be seen face to face, we
does
could
that
do
count
it.
Me? They'll just all be scared and run away.
No. Then we could do it a different way, where we would just do a phone interview if you know not comfortable with that, and that would be fine too. But we'd be interested in doing that. And we would like to officially put out the call to those of you who would be interested in doing an interview. Basically, we want to branch out in terms of species or types of setups that we haven't done a lot. Because, you know, someone asked recently about really large tank buster fish, and I haven't had any. I haven't had really big fish. I mean, I've had some fairly large goldfish. But the largest tank we've ever had is a 55. Dug a couple of ponds, I guess, in my life. But other than that, I haven't had, you know, a lot of experience with really big fish. So that would be an interesting one. People who have kept really large fish
Didn't
in really
we do
large
one on
tanks.
That with Mick?
We've done tank busters with Mick, yes. Yeah. And I think that was a great interview. But I'm talking like specific species. That one was, you know.
Just big fish in general.
Big fish in general, what you need to keep in mind when you're keeping. And that was great. What I mean is like someone wants to talk about their paku, you know.
Okay.
I have pakus in a 750-gallon tank or whatever, you know, and they want to talk about that. And not just pakus and not just large tanks. It's just one possibility. If you have kept seahorses, for example, I'd love to do a show on seahorses. Or whatever, moray eels. Elephant nose fish, you know? Whatever. Just something we haven't done, we haven't kept. I'd love to do an interview on what you're keeping. It doesn't even have to be something crazy. I've never kept pencil fish before. Plenty of people do. I never have. So, you know, you want to talk about pencil fish. Whatever it is. Or if it's something that's just aquarium related but not necessarily a species profile, it could be something else too. So whatever. Please just contact us if you're interested in doing that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there we go.
Okay, he goes on, I have finally remembered to put a spare SD card in my camera and have tonight managed to come up with two very poor pictures and one video of the goldfish fry, which are now about 6 weeks old. Feel free to share them on your pages for all to see, which we will happily do.
Yeah, it was cool to see the little, wee little more goldfish. They don't have the color yet, they don't have the shape really, but they are cute little fish. Babies. It's fun to watch them develop too.
Mm-hmm. He also sent us another video of his cichlids.
Mm-hmm. He said he had picked them up a couple of weeks ago.
Moliway?
They're Pelvic Acromis moliway. I'm sure, I don't know exactly how to pronounce
cichlids.
It.
Cichlids. So he sent us the email for that, not the email, the video for that too, so we'll put that one up.
Right,
too.
And they're with his pencil fish, his Beckford Eye pencil fish. Mm-hmm. Moliway are similar to Cribensis. They're in the same genus as Cribensis, and they look very similar. So they're a cool fish. And it's interesting, you see the female at one point digging the gravel. She looks like a little earth eater, kind of fun. Mm-hmm. So check that out, and we will put those on the show page.
So there you go. Thank you, Mick.
And please take to heart his idea and our idea to do an interview. If you're interested at all, just send us an email. Put us on the Facebook page, whatever, and we'll try to see if we can set it up.
Yeah. Okay, should we go to Joe in Hudsonville, Michigan?
Yes, let's do so.
He says, hello, Kelly and Russ. I love that. Just wanted to check in and post a picture of my daughters, Ginny and Chloe's tank. Plants are filling in and shrimp population has boomed. Went from 8 to lots. And he sent us a picture of it.
Yeah, and so you've got lots of lovely red shrimp in with his fish. He's got some neons and some cardinals, looks like, in there. And it's one of the examples, you know, that the shrimp and the fish can get along if they're the right mm-hmm. fish and the right shrimp and in the right
and
setup.
The right hiding spots. Yeah.
Like when I had a tank full of neons in Hawaii, I had a lot of shrimp that were reproducing there.
It's true.
So it can be done. Mm-hmm. Lots of fish it doesn't work with, but those are some that it does.
And he says, love the show. Keep the audio format. I like listening to you guys while I'm at work welding.
So we get a lot of, we've had a lot of feedback on that. Mm-hmm. It sounds like no one's opposed to the YouTube, but so many people really want the audio to keep going. So
we'll try to keep doing that.
Yep.
Okay. Juliet in Paris, France. She says, hello, Russ and Kelly. Assassin snails. Who lays the eggs? I had an explosion of ramshorn snails in a shrimp tank. I put in one assassin, but it wasn't enough. The second assassin I got a month ago was very large and almost white. The first one, a common yellow and dark brown striped one, made a beeline for it, and they stayed joined together for a day. I was convinced that the yellow one was the male, as it had sought out the other one. Despite being told that they reproduced slowly, yesterday I found over 20 eggs stuck all over the tank. They look like little square plastic sandwich bags with a round white egg inside.
They totally do. That's a good explanation.
This was a bit too many for my needs, so I separated the two adults. However, this morning I found a young assassin snail in a tank, maybe a quarter of an inch long, feeding with the shrimp. This means that he was born before the arrival of the second snail, so I figured the first yellow and brown one was the female, and had already been carrying fertilized eggs and had laid a previous batch. Or are they hermaphrodites, but need another snail to reproduce with? In which case, both can lay eggs? What is the answer? And how many eggs can these guys lay in a month? Because it looks like I'm going to have to make provisions for quite a large batch of juveniles. Both adults are now in separate tanks. Juliet.
Okay.
Good question.
Excellent questions. My understanding, I don't have any scientific research to back this up, but my understanding is that assassin snails are not hermaphrodites, that they have male snails and female snails, unlike many other types of snails. So, could be wrong about that, but that's what I've read, that's what I've heard. One thing to point out that may reassure you a bit, Juliet, is that their eggs take longer to hatch than most snail eggs. You know, you get the pond snails or the ram's horn snails, and as long as the temperature is fairly warm, in a couple of weeks they've hatched and they're all over the place. Assassin snail eggs seem to take longer than other snails to hatch, and when they do, they don't always hatch either. The infertility rate is high, or I guess I should say the fertility rate for the eggs appears to be low. So for every egg you see doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get a snail. As you noticed, you know, the snails also tend to appear once they're much bigger than they are when they must hatch. I've never seen a newly hatched assassin snail, even though I've had, I don't know how many, many, many assassin snails hatch. I've never seen one smaller than about that size that you mentioned, I don't think, about a quarter of an inch long. They seem to show up at about that size, and people have assumed that they bury themselves in the substrate and run around and eat detritus and things in there until they're old enough to come out. So you probably won't get a huge number of snails that will overtake the tank, partly because of the infertility, partly because they take longer to hatch, and partly because once they're out of other snails to eat, their egg-laying rate just dives. They lay very few eggs. So once they've taken care of your snail problem, you probably won't see very many more of them hatch.
Is there, I mean, I think all the ones that we've had have been the same yellow and brown striped ones that she's talking
right.
about.
Right.
Is there any dimorphism to tell them apart?
Not that I have been able to tell.
Not really.
I just figured, oh, that one appears to be seeking out the other one and mating with it, so it's probably the male. But, yeah.
Although in Juliet's case, it seemed to be.
Yeah, one of them seemed to look quite a bit different. That's interesting.
Well, and the one that was already in there was the one that's sought out the other one. That's why she was thinking at first it was the male, and then it turned out that
she says
maybe it laid some eggs already before.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know.
Maybe she was just lonely.
Maybe so. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that they are hermaphrodites, and what I've read is not true. Could be.
It's hard to tell. Okay. Shall we go to Tom in Provo?
Yes.
And the subject line in his email says, "Dead fish in my tank." And then it goes on to the email. "In fact, all of them are dead. It was an overnight problem with the CO2, which has now been remedied, but I have a couple of questions about restoring in the tank. The first morning, I found the fish dead. I could not really face it and left it all to the next day. As it turned out, they were still all dead. Go figure! And the water was becoming cloudy, which I presume was the start of a bacterial bloom. At least one nerite snail does seem to have survived. I have done a roughly 90% water change, and will continue that regularly until I'm sure the bloom is gone and other water parameters are stable. I noticed, though, that there's an oily layer on top of the new water, something I had not noticed in the past. I'm concerned that this may promote the propagation of mycobacterium. I remember that Mick was a fan of some kind of film that could remove such layers, but I don't remember what it was called. Do you? Are there other things I need to be aware of before reintroducing fish? How long would one typically wait? Hope you were still there and answering questions. As I said earlier, I don't write in much, but I never missed a podcast, except the last 2 weeks when there does not seem to have been one. Best wishes to the whole Wilson clan. Beatus est pisciculus. Thank you, Tom." Yes, we had technical difficulties that we didn't notice until you told us that the podcast didn't actually go out, so thank you for pointing it out.
It was sitting up there in the cloud waiting to rain down upon you all, but it hadn't yet, so I just...
Instead, it was a drought.
Flip a couple of switches, and it was out. So thank you for letting us know. And it came a little late. I think it maybe came out on Saturday instead of Wednesday, but it's out. And then
you'll get this one.
Then this one's coming up. So
sorry about that, guys.
Okay, now let's talk about what's going on. So I believe the roughly 90% water change was a good idea in this case, because you know there's going to be a lot of scary gunk in there. But I would say once you've done the 90% water change, you can probably dial back a little bit on the water changes and just keep, you know, checking the parameters and seeing if the bacteria are calming down, because you don't want to take away everything from the tank, or otherwise there won't be any nutrients and you'll starve the bacteria, the beneficial bacteria. So unless the plants are, you know, there are enough plants in the tank that that's basically what's taking place of the cycle, is you have plants sequestering all the ammonia right away, and then you don't need to worry about that so much. But the oily layer is kind of scary. And I believe the material that Mick suggested was Chemipure, C-H-E-M-I-P-U-R-E. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And Mick, can you confirm or deny that statement? That would be helpful. So, and I don't think it's a film. It's more like a particulate resin that you put in the filter or something like that. Or a bag full of particulate resin that you put in the filter. And as it runs through, it takes the gunk out. But I would say, you know, after doing the 90% water change, maybe do 25% or 50% and then slow it down and just keep checking the parameters. You don't want to let it go too long, even though that sounds paradoxical, because in this case it wasn't fish disease that caused it. It was the CO2 issue that you've remedied. It might be a problem if you go too long. Once again, you don't want to starve the bacteria. So I would say once your parameters are stable and you have zero ammonia, zero nitrites, and you're probably going to have low nitrates anyway with the plants in there, that you can go ahead and reintroduce some fish. As long, and you know, there's no visible bacterial bloom and all of the parameters are stable, pH is stable, of course, then I would introduce some. So there you go.
Okay. Jeremiah in Grand Rapids, Michigan says, hello, I decided not to bother with an email with the issues. Oh, the email issues.
Yeah, but they seem to be resolved now.
But we have a house now, or at least they accepted the bid. Now we just have to wait for closing and occupancy, and we will be that much closer to the Oscar fish. It has a perfect herp invert room as well.
Congratulations.
That is an exciting process. Yep, we'll an exciting keep... and gut-twisting and stressful process, and I wish you very well in it, and that it will not be any more stressful than it has to be.
Yeah, and I hope it goes through for you, and you are able to get it and get the Oscar fish and their herp and invert room. We have a fish/herp/invert room too. We've probably talked about that before, but mm-hmm. That was one thing we wanted to find in this house. We needed a sewing project room and a
joking about that
room.
The other day about some guys have man caves where they watch football and drink beer and do silly things, and Russ has a critter room instead.
And you like that?
Yes, I much prefer that.
So anyway, yeah, let us know how it goes, and we hope that you're able to get your Oscar tank. Maybe you could do the interview with us about your Oscar tank and setting it all up and what you think about your Oscars and all that. That'd be fun.
Okay, so good luck with that. It's time for that station break thingy when I tell you how you can play an active part in the Aquarimax community. If you want your questions or comments featured on the show, send us an email at info@aquarimax.com or call and leave a message at 801-477-0629. You can also subscribe to the Aquarimax YouTube channel, like our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter.
And now for a blatant but extremely brief plug.
Our ebook, The Aquarimax Guide to 7 Easy Live Foods, is available on Amazon.com for $2.99. Should we go to Paul in Central California?
Yes.
Finn's person.
Yes.
Says, greetings from Central California. As you know from Finn's email back in April, he has moved into a new 37-gallon Bowfront tank that he enjoys tremendously. Almost immediately after the move, I noticed that the water in the tank took on a boggy smell and algae started to grow on the glass plants and decorations at an alarming rate. Even with our weekly water changes, the smell and algae growth kept getting worse. Soon there was no doubt. The homemade internal filter that had worked so well for so long just wasn't able to keep up with the larger volume of water and the larger volume of Finn.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back to the success my father had with an undergravel filter in his 20-gallon community tank throughout the 1970s, Finn and I thought we might give that old-fashioned filter design a try. Some Google research revealed that the once celebrated and revered undergravel filter design is nowadays considered to be mediocre at best, and regarded by many of the aquarium hobby as a poor performer or even detrimental to aquarium health. Not to be dissuaded by currently popular filter opinion, we decided to build one and see for ourselves how it works. Two airstones, a length of airline tubing, and a dual-output aquarium air pump set us back $12 at Walmart. Some half-inch PVC pipe and various PVC pipe fittings cost another $15 at a local hardware store. After about 30 minutes of cutting, drilling, and fitting the PVC, we had a network of perforated tubes to cover the bottom of the tank, and two risers to act as airlift tubes that would pull water up from the bottom and release it at the top of the tank near the water surface. Finn had to chill in a large Tupperware container while I drained his tank, removed all the decorations and substrate, installed a new homemade undergravel filter, and finally replaced the substrate and decorations. After returning the water and Finn to the tank and hooking up the airstones and air pump, we noticed a strong water flow and considerable surface agitation provided by the new filter. Please see the attached video clip, which we will put up for you guys. No cycle time was needed because I reused the gravel substrate that apparently had lots of nitrogen fixing bacteria living in it already. For the past several months now, the undergravel filter experiment has been a total success. Finn's tank is nice and clean and the water smells sweet, a little bit like fresh garden soil.
Exactly as it should.
Mm-hmm. Algae growth is almost non-existent. With every water change, I carefully vacuum the gravel substrate because it now catches all the solid waste in the tank. With all the wiggling earthworms that Finn eats, there's a lot of solid waste. I'm curious to know your thoughts on the old-fashioned undergravel filter and if you have ever used one. Finn and I would like to hear your comments. Thanks, Paul.
And we did check out his tank in the video he sent, and it looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
I like how the black PVC... You know, it's almost, you can't see it. As we started to look at the video, Kelly was like, oh, you can't see the filter. Because it doesn't really show up until the camera zoomed in on the filter mm-hmm. uplift tubes, and then you could see it. But you don't really notice it that much. And so it makes the tank look nice and uncluttered. So you can pay attention to Finn and to the decorations and the plants and so on. So I think it's a good idea. There are some caveats to be aware of when you're using an undergravel filter, but it sounds like you're addressing those just fine so far. I have used them. In fact, I used undergravel filters for years. I started keeping aquariums, I guess, before I knew what undergravel filters were. But after not too long, I started out with a little box corner filter. It was the first kind of filter I remember using. But after a few years, switched over to the undergravel filters. The commercial ones that are the plates with the little slits in them, and then you put the uplift tubes in the corners and twist them in, and then you put the uplift tubes in through the top and all that. So similar in structure to yours, except rather than network of tubes on the bottom, they were plates with slits in them. I think they work great if you pay attention to a few things, and one is that you need to make sure the substrate is the right depth. If it's too deep, then the flow doesn't really work anymore. So you also need to make sure it's the right grain size. If you don't want the gravel to be too large grained or too small grained. Too small grains, you don't get any flow, and too large grained kind of have the opposite problem. There's maybe too much flow, so it doesn't, hold it, so you can vacuum it up. Let's see. You also want to make sure you don't rest any large decorations over patches of substrate on top of the undergravel filter itself. If you want to put larger things like rocks or driftwood that are going to cover a large area, put them directly on the filter and then put the substrate around it. Let's see. You also need to vacuum regularly, which sounds like you're doing. You want to make sure you get all the gravel fairly frequently. You don't want to do maybe all of the gravel every time the whole tank. But if you do half of it, each time you do it or something like that, you work out a rotational system. So you are getting solid waste. That is extremely important to get rid of the solid waste. Otherwise, it accumulates down under there and you don't see it, but it's still doing harm to the water quality. So that's one of the problems that people often encounter is they don't really realize that. And so even though the water looks clear, it's building up outrageous quantities of nitrate and it's becoming acidic and things like that, which can be bad. Another one is that the air stones will give out. So when you notice any reduction in water flow, make sure to address that. Replace the air stones. Hopefully you have a check valve on each of the pumps that you have. I think you said you had a dual pump. Check valve is good to make sure there's not back pressure being put on the pumps to cause damage. And that'll help preserve their life. And even if you have a little bit of a clogged air stone, it's not going to damage the pump so much with a check valve. I would say you know, depending on the type of airstone you have, some you can clean off and use them again, some you can't. But just make sure the airstones are always in good working order and replace or repair them as needed so that your flow is always good. And then you should be fine with the cleaning out of the gravel, regular maintenance on the tubes. And it may come to the point where the tubes themselves become clogged and you may have to take those out and give them a good cleaning with like a foxtail brush. Hopefully that won't be for a while though. Okay, I think that's about it. I think you can do well with undergravel filter. Like I said, I've used them for years and I don't anymore, but I have, and they seem to work.
Okay. Should we go to Ken in Brazil?
Yeah.
Yes, he says, "Hello, this is Ken from São Mateus, Brazil. I'm retired from Pennsylvania in the U.S. I moved here about 4 years ago. About 3 years ago, a friend here gave me a betta as a gift. I'd always had aquariums while in Pennsylvania. The betta in a bowl sparked my interest in aquariums again. My first purchase here was a 5-gallon tank to keep my new pet, plus a few neons and a cori. Of course, no one who loves fish can ever be completely satisfied with any aquarium smaller than a lake. Now I have 2 40-gallon tanks plus the original 5-gallon. I still have a betta in the 5, mixed tropical fish in 140 and cichlids in the other. The cichlids are a new experience for me. I've only had them for about 2 months, but I love the colors and personalities of these. Of these guys. Here in Brazil, it is difficult to get good information about fish that you purchase. For example, all of my cichlids came out of a tank labeled cichlids. It took a lot of internet searching to try to figure out what I was buying. Here is my question. Where I'm living, we are close to the ocean. We are also in a drought for the last few years. When there are periods of no rain, the ocean water flows up the river, mixing with the city water. So you get salty water from your tap. Not pure ocean water, but over what salt level is good. I know that you can't know the concentration of salt, and I have no way to measure it, but do you think that if I dilute this water with bottled drinking water, it would be okay? Most information I've seen says that tropical fish like some salt. Will a hydrometer measure these small salt levels? Thanks in advance, Ken."
And he also says...
Oh, he says, "P.S., please keep podcasting."
Okay.
And he's got some pictures for us, too.
Yes. It's an interesting problem that you have there. I would say it depends on the fish and it depends on the concentration of salt water. It wouldn't hurt to try one of the cheap hydrometers or hygrometers that you can get and just see if you get measurable salt and see what it's saying. And I would imagine that it would fluctuate some, too. Sounds like what you're saying, that the concentration of salt in your tap water could fluctuate quite a bit from day to day, week to week, season to season, that kind of thing. So I would go ahead and try to buy one and see if you can get that to work. Or try a TDS, a total dissolved solids meter. That could be useful too. That could help you figure out how much salt is in your tank as well. So yeah, it doesn't sound like a particularly good situation. Some fish, of course, could handle it just fine, but others not so well. Like coris are usually not so tolerant of salt, neons not so much, betta's a bit more. The cichlids, depending on the species, some cichlids are pretty tolerant of salt, some less so. From the pictures, I like the pictures, I like your setup, how you have your tanks too. It looks like that most of the cichlids you have are probably mbunas. The picture's from a little bit far away, so I couldn't identify any species or anything, but it looked like they were mbunas to me. And those could probably handle a little salt, since their water, where they come from, it doesn't have the composition of ocean water remotely. It's quite a bit different, but it does have a lot of dissolved solids in it. And some salts are often used in cichlid mixes. Some, like, ocean-type salt is used as a component of the cichlid mixes that people will make to keep them in. They'll put, like, some baking soda and some Epsom salts and some sea salt in. So I think they could probably handle more. And, you know, a lot of fish are pretty adaptable. In Hawaii, near where we used to live, they had tilapia that lived in the ocean and in the streams and ponds and whatever around, and then the storm drains and everywhere. They had adapted to live in the ocean. Some fish are pretty adaptable that way. So I would say, you know, Amazon fish like bettas that are from, you know, fairly water with fairly low dissolved solids in them are not going to like it as much, although bettas are more tolerant than, say, corys. But I would say that measuring it is going to, it's going to be a good thing. So hopefully works out for you. Let us know what you find out.
Okay. And we've got Matt in Perth, Western Australia. Says, G'day, Russ and Kelly. I have attached a few photos of the 180-liter marine to this email. I bought a blue tang and naturally named her Dory, which I think is fabulous because I feel a special, certain, absent-minded kinship with Dory, and I love her. If Dory grows too big for the tank, I will just trade her back to the fish shop. Tangs apparently grow slowly, though, so that is not going to be for a while. My photos don't have Dory in them, but she is a little sick right now, so I'll wait to put some of her up. Well, put up, you know, pictures of some of her. She has ick. I am treating her ick with crystalline peroxide salts. Apparently, it is the only reef-safe treatment that my local fish shop has. It cost $80. Holy cow. That is a lot for a fish medicine. However, Dory cost $100, so if it works, it will be worth it. I have heard that it can wipe out fish populations. I also heard that certain fish are more vulnerable than others. None of the other fish are showing signs of ick, so that makes me feel good.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, hopefully none of them get it. I had a small starfish die on me. Now, apparently, starfish are poisonous, and when they die, they release that poison into the water.
There are a lot of marine organisms that do that. Just saying.
Poisonous to eat them, or they're venomous if they bite?
Well, there. What I mean is there are a lot of marine organisms mm-hmm. that can release toxins into the water, either before they die, and thus killing themselves and everything else, or damaging, mm-hmm. you know, causing damage, or after they die. Hmm. There are a lot of them. A lot of fish like that do
it's
that.
It's kind of a spiteful like, thing to do on your way out of this life.
Pufferfish that can do that, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This may be why Dory's ick is now showing up. The torch coral is looking stressed, as are the mushrooms. However, the rest of the tank is looking fine, so I'm not too worried. I am doing daily 5% water changes, one bucket, until all the corals look happy again. I tried to remove the body, but could only find small bits of it. The starfish dissolved in about 2 days. It was incredibly fast. Which is a good sign, as it means there's a healthy population of bacteria in the tank working away at any waste products.
And there may also be isopods and amphipods mm-hmm. helping you out there, too.
That's good. My smaller previous pilot project, 54-liter marine, has taught me that you can have nutrients go out of control real fast in a small tank. One coral dies and raises the ammonia levels in the aquarium. That causes the next coral to die, and the process can spiral out of control fast. In that vein, it was a real dilemma to me when I see a sick-looking coral. If the coral is actually dead, I should remove it immediately. However, I do not know if it is dead, and if it is not dead, I do not want to kill an ill but otherwise okay coral. I completely understand why people have hospital tanks now. That way you can isolate a sick-looking fish or coral until it gets better or dies. Either way, it won't cause problems in the main tank. One of the attached photos shows the torch coral looking healthy and expanded. It now is shrunk and stressed. Dead corals actually start to break apart and the bits float through the water column. This has yet to happen with my torch coral, so I think he's just upset right now. He is under high flow too, so if it was dead, the flow should increase the chances of bits of him floating away. Do you think I should put him in a low flow area until he recovers? What is your procedure when you have sick fish, plants, or coral? Do you isolate them or just monitor them in the main aquarium? Do you have a hospital aquarium?
That's a really good question. I think...
We used to have hospital tanks.
Yeah, we have had hospital tanks in the past. Right now, we don't have any set up, but we're not doing a lot of fish coming in or, you know, new fish coming in. We just have the aquatic critters that we have, and so we don't have a hospital tank set up. We haven't had a lot of issues with diseases that we've had to worry about it. I do have an empty tank, so if I needed to set one up, I could do that. But, yeah, we haven't done that for a while. But they have been useful in the past. And I'm not sure, honestly, what to do with the coral. If there's anyone out there who can offer some words of advice about whether it needs to go to a low flow area or not, that would be welcome. But I do like to watch fish when they're sick, and it depends to me on the setup, whether I isolate them immediately or not, and what kind of sickness they appear to have and things like that. Like when I had some rainbow fish, the dwarf neon rainbow fish, all came down with mycobacteriosis at about the same time, I did not feel it would be useful to isolate them
from each other. Since they all had
it. Because they were all getting it at about the same time, and I thought it would be pretty useless to do so. And in fact, it was. There's not much you can do with mycobacteria either, so once a fish is in the state they were in. So I didn't do that. But we've had other fish. For example, we had a number of years ago had a goldfish that started looking sick, and it looked like it might have, it had dropsy, symptoms of dropsy. So we immediately set up a hospital tank and isolated it.
Which one was that?
That was Applefishy.
Applefishy.
Gwen's fish.
That she got for her second birthday.
Yeah, and he did well for several years, but...
She was crushed when he died.
Yeah, he got mycobacterium, and it was really sad. Luckily, we haven't dealt with that particular awful disease for some time now, but...
The UV filter, I don't think we've had it since you got the UV,
yeah,
or not filter, UV, but UV sterilizer thing.
Yeah, that helped a lot. So, I think hospital tanks are worth it, and they've been helpful in the past. So, I would say it's good to have one if you're going to do a lot of, if you're going to be acquiring new fish, or you have a lot of different fish together, or anything, it's good to have one, and even if you... It's just good to have one anyway. I should probably just have one all the time.
Okay, Matt also says, I had two stunning moonlight gouramis in my planted aquarium. Unfortunately, they love ripping up my plants to try and make a nest with them. So I traded them in yesterday, and now all my plants are staying in the soil. Oh boy, it feels good to not be replanting some of my plants daily. How do you deal with bad behavior?
Well, I think you... you've done one of the things that I have done. I have taken fish
naughty
back to the
fish
store
back
when
to the store.
They have done things that I can't deal with anymore, like
Siamese algae eaters.
Siamese algae eaters actually attacked another fish and pulled
out
its
eye. Applefishy.
Yes, it was another
one.
Fish. It was
I thought you meant another one other than applefishy.
No, I just mean they attacked another fish.
Yeah.
And let's see. I have had a couple of placos go kind of bad on us too, where they became aggressive, and I've done that. But some other things that I've done, I have put a net breeder in a corner of a tank. Sometimes when you have fish that have pronounced dominance hierarchies, I've sometimes put the offending fish in a net breeder for 2 or 3 days, maybe move the decor around a little bit to allow the other fish to establish territories, and then release that fish back into the tank. And sometimes that does the trick. Sometimes the fish is no longer aggressive because it feels like it's
the new fish.
The new fish on the block, and the other fish feel a little bit more comfortable where they are, and so it's no longer the alpha fish and the terror of the tank. So sometimes I've done that. Or sometimes you just put that fish in another tank that's away from all those fish. You can keep it, but put it somewhere else, and I've done that too. So, but in this case, I think it's not so much a case of bad behavior, but of undesirable
just
behavior that is natural for the
natural
fish.
Natural behavior, yeah.
So I think what you did was probably the best thing you could have done. If you want to, you have to choose plants or fish. One of them's got to go, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Okay, one last thing for Matt. He says, have you ever kept Cribensis cichlids before? I recently added 4 to my planted tank along with 4 golden rams, and they are gorgeous. I'm amazed at how colorful they became almost immediately and how well they have settled in. Then he says, ciao.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, I have kept Cribensis before and had a lot of fun with them. I really, really enjoyed them. They are beautiful fish. I love how both the female and the male are very colorful. The female has this kind of red ventral area. So what would roughly correspond to the neck and chest area on the fish. And it's really, really cool. It's kind of a rosy reddish color, I guess. And then that's not the only color on the female. And then the male is colorful too. But he has more like yellow and different stripes and stuff. Very, very attractive fish. A lot of fun. They spawned for me. They're cheap too. They were only like $3.99 each or something. Found a pair. They produced several broods of babies. I think the first one they ate, which is not uncommon for cichlids to do. And then after that, they produced, I don't remember if it was 2 batches they ate or whatever, but they produced another batch of about 40 baby Cribensis, and it was so fun to watch them parade around the tank, and they were little pigs, the little fish were, and they would eat the microworms and things that I put in there for them. They're big enough when they hatch, like most cichlids, that they didn't need like infusoria or anything like that. They could start with microworms or baby brine shrimp. And so they were really pretty easy to raise. And when they got to be about an inch and a half long or so, I brought them to a guy who has huge, gigantic fish room and traded them for credit. And it was fun. Unfortunately, shortly after I did that, or maybe it was shortly before, I don't remember, the male just died. And I couldn't figure out why. It wasn't like he was sick. He was fine one day, and the next day he was dead. And it was depressing. It was very sad. Because I probably would have just kept breeding those. They were so fun. But then I didn't want to try to pair the female up with another male, because it's hard to find mature males in the pet store. Usually you find younger ones and so on. So I just figured... And there was another problem, too, is that the pH of the water affects the gender of the fish. Like, you'll get around neutral pH, if I remember correctly, you get approximately 50% ratio males and females. But at a higher pH, you get more males, I think it is, and a lower pH, you get more females, or vice versa. Anyway, so I was worried that was going to be a problem in the future. When I traded them in, he didn't mind. He didn't care what I had, whether they were males or females. But anyway, I did have a lot of fun with them. I wouldn't mind having a pair of Cubensis again. They were really, really attractive fish and just fun to keep and fun to watch. So, yes, I guess that was a really long answer to your question. But I like them.
Okay. Oh, we have one more. Mick sent in another one. Mm-hmm. I guess we had two from Mick. So he says, Brill show last week. A really good range of topics and very good outline on developing guppy strains. I had a really nice pair of magenta roundtails a few years ago. The babies from these were all a real Heinz 57 mix, with no two guppies having anything like the same colors. I followed the strategy that Russ outlined last week by selecting a batch of fry and separating out the sexes as early as possible. I then grew on the females and crossed them back with the paternal male, which gave me the original colors on every one. It is time-consuming to do and takes up a few tanks, but the F2 fry then all had the colors fixed.
Yeah.
I received my new additions to the collection, a few Teleocycla centaurcus. They are a lovely cichlid, but still very shy while they settle in. I have put them in a riverine-type setup with some pencil fish I had in with my Pelvica chromis molyewis that we talked about in the other email.
Mm-hmm.
My OCD was struggling mixing West African with South American. Yet I will send some pictures or video when they are showing off a bit more.
That would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Regarding Juliet's worm cultures, she could try looking on the French eBay. I know there are lots of food cultures available here on the UK one.
Good idea.
Yeah. Alternatively, frozen cyclops would be good, and Ocean Nutrition make their instant baby brine shrimp, which I've used with great success and no hatching. And he has a link in there, so we can put that up for Juliet. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I've used both frozen cyclops. Actually, I don't know if I've used frozen baby brine shrimp or not. But I've used live ones, of course. But
seems like we have.
We may
have a memory of them, like the cube of them opening and dissolving in the water.
Yeah, we probably have. And the frozen cyclops, I like those too. So those are good ideas. And one thing to remember is that fish do go through a learning curve with food. And if they don't like it the first time, you can always try it again. Kind of like little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And try it 15 times, and eventually they may pick it up. I've had plenty of fish do that. So it might be worth a try. It sounds good. And I like the idea of the French eBay too. So, I think that's about all for this week, everyone. Yes. I think we should probably celebrate the fact that we had so many contributors today, and from 5 different countries, no less.
How do we celebrate?
By saying, yay!
Yay!
And saying also,
may the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.